It's the Trupany Show with your host, James Trupany.
My name is James Trupany, and this is my show. And today we are talking FMW, Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling. And my guest at this time is Miss Chelsea Spollen. How are you?
Doing okay. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much. Though obviously we had some things happen on this side of the Atlantic last night which are not very good. And we hope we can take you away from those horrible thoughts for an hour. And obviously the thoughts of everybody at WrestleTalk TV are with our friends in London. And we hope all of our London crew are safe, because a lot of our WrestleTalk crew live in London. So we hope they're all okay. Yeah, today we are looking at Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling. We're looking at two shows from 1991 as we continue the beginner's guide to professional wrestling in Japan. And FMW, we looked at it a few weeks ago, didn't we, Chelsea? And it was an interesting time.
It's certainly unlike anything else. There's no other wrestling product that's exactly like FMW.
No, that's true. And these shows, I thought, were a good counterpoint to what we watched last week, where it was pure shoot fighting kind of MMA crossover. And this was as well, but done in a completely different way. And it produces some very interesting results. And also, Chelsea, you kind of like drew parallels when we were discussing doing these with what happened to the women in FMW and these extreme matches that the women in the WWE are going to be tackling in the next few weeks.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, so what happens in FMW is a lot more extreme than what happens in WWE, of course. But, I mean, it does seem to be a good time to be talking about it, because the women in WWE have never been allowed to have a Money in the Bank ladder match before, and they're also, there's a kendo stick on a pole match that's coming up, which, like, I don't even know what that's going to look like in WWE, so, yeah, I don't know, it was just an interesting parallel in my mind.
You know when Russo rang up WWE, and did Vince just go, oh, on a pole, and that's, is that what happened? I don't know. Anyway.
I don't know, but Alexa Bliss doesn't even look like she's tall enough to be in one of those matches, so I don't know how they're going to do it.
Well, we'll go back to FMW, which is where we're supposed to be, and there was a show on the 29th of May 1991 called Shōjenki, which was pretty much a regular house show, but there was some interesting stuff happened on it. It was a fairly big show, 5,235 people in attendance at Otta Ward Gymnasium. Now, on the commercial release of the tape, which you can find in many different places on the internet, it was only an hour long, and they concentrated on the last five matches. So today, we're just going to concentrate on those last five matches, because this is the important bit. And it also gives us a flavor of what was happening to FMW in 1991, and also it leads us into the second anniversary show, the biggest show of the year for FMW. So, and we've got some other things to talk about well with FMW. What was your overall thoughts on this card, Chelsea?
So this was interesting. This felt a little more fully formed than some of the FMW product that I've watched. It felt like, almost like, you know how sometimes house shows are like a big practice for a pay-per-view?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This kind of felt like that.
Yeah. There wasn't...
I'm sorry, I cut you off.
I was going to say, there wasn't... The stories weren't the big stories that we kind of see in the next couple of shows. It was things that were developing, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it felt like the thing that FMW is kind of known for. FMW is known for hardcore stuff, but it's also known for the diversity of styles that they have there. And I felt like this show showcased that really, really well, because there's a lot of variety in here.
Yeah, definitely. And the first match is kind of an example of that. It was an AWA World Light Heavyweight title match. By this time, the AWA didn't really exist, so it didn't really matter who had the belt. And this title would get replaced in FMW in coming years with the Independent World's Junior Heavyweight Championship. And in this match, Ricky Fuji was wrestling Jimmy Backlund, as we said at the time, two of the greatest mullets available in pro wrestling in 1991.
That's the first thing in my notes, James, is amazing mullets.
Yeah, they are just, they're stunning, aren't they? It's just a thing of beauty, these two.
Ricky Fuji still has that haircut, by the way.
Yeah.
He's bleaching it blonde now, but it's still the long, flowing, unbrushed locks.
Yes, yes, with kind of like a bird's nest attempt on the head and long at the back. And this is several parties at the front.
Seems to work for him.
Yeah. Jimmy Backlund rocking more of a classic mullet, though, I felt.
Yes.
This match went 10 minutes and 7 seconds. Now, considering what was going on in junior heavyweight wrestling at the time, this was much more of a traditional kind of small heavyweight kind of match rather than what we'd expect a light heavyweight match to be. And if you look around what was going on in New Japan with Jushin Thunder Liger and what was going on in All Japan with Tiger Mask 2, this was a bit different. What did you think of this matchup?
So this is interesting. It feels a little like there's something missing. And maybe it is that this whole show has that big house show feel, so they're not really, like, going for it the way they would if it was a bigger event. There's some chain wrestling at the beginning that's somewhere between stiff and what I think of as, like, the current WWE style. So I guess in that sense, it feels kind of modern. Like, it feels like a match that you would see on Monday Night Raw.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The crowd kind of politely applauds through most of the first half, and then, like, it kind of seems like nobody cares in the middle. And then by the end of it, after there's been, like, a crossbody to the outside of the ring and stuff like that, then the crowd gets invested. It's interesting to me, but it's also not, like, it didn't feel like a fully finished, we've decided on exactly how we're going to have this match beforehand, and we've planned out, you know, yeah, a perfect story to tell you kind of thing. It just kind of felt like some of it they were doing on the fly.
Yeah, and it wasn't necessarily a good on the fly.
Yeah. One thing I did notice, though, is that the camera work for the way they filmed this match feels really modern compared to a lot of other products I've seen from the 90s. Like, we watched an AJW show from 91 not that long ago, and yeah, this is filmed way, way, way better. Like, way better. It was really surprising to me.
But at this point, like, FNW had started to make good money. Anita was charging, just signed a Laserdisc deal. So they wanted good quality video because they were doing a Laserdisc. And I think they got a $25,000 signing bonus for signing with that laser deal, laser disc distribution company. So they wanted the best quality stuff to go on the discs. So they had to invest in the camera work. So they invested in a 9-camera set and a new production truck. And it was clearly paying off at this particular point, especially now, yeah, you know, that we watch this on low quality file sharing 26 years after the fact, and it still stands up. It's very watchable. You see some old tapes that have been copied off VHS, and there's bits of flat spots where it's been worn back and forth. None of that. This is pretty cool stuff, isn't it? It's pretty high quality.
Yeah, the camera work feels like Monday Night Raw, which is, I mean, like a lot of independent shows now that have, you know, camera crews there don't rise to that level.
Okay, then. We'll move on to a different style fight, which is the next match of Horace Boulder, erstwhile cousin of Hulk Hogan, Mike Awesome, the Gladiator, as he was known in FMW, who wrestled in a tag match against Boris Gogishlevsky. I think I got that right. Gogishvili and Sambo Osaka, who was a resident MMA kind of guy for FMW. I'm not sure he was that MMA, but they used him as an MMA guy. And this was an interesting tag team match because Horace and Mike Awesome kind of just wrestle it as a straight big man tag team should do, and the other guys just kind of bump around for them. But it was a fun and different thing, and it was a different way of presenting wrestling with this kind of match, and certainly didn't do any harm to the Horace Boulder and the Gladiator, who would go on to be the monster heel tag team for FMW in the next couple of years. What do you think of this?
I wrote in my notes, this is pretty weird. the martial artists don't really know how to make the wrestling look good, and the wrestlers kind of seem like they're trying to they're sort of like reaching out of their wheelhouse and just throwing a lot of kicks and stomping on people. And it just, I don't know, it just kind of felt like nobody was really doing the things that made them great for most of this match, you know? Like, I felt like if the wrestlers had had a match with other wrestlers, or the martial artists had had a match with other martial artists, it would have been a little better.
Bit smoother.
Also, I wasn't a big fan of the chair shots to the head.
No, I did notice that a lot, because we don't see them anymore, ever. And some of this was very near the knuckle.
Yeah,
it was not good. We'll move on then to the WWA Women's Championship match, again with champion Megumi Kudo defending against Delta Dawn. Now, you may remember Delta Dawn as somebody else who we talked about on the AJW podcast when we talked a couple of months ago, and that was Bertha Faye, or Monster Ripper, as she was known in AJW. Now, this card actually happened slightly before that AJW match, if I'm remembering correctly. And this was a pretty good match for the WWA Women's Championship, the big championship in FMW for women. But I'd also like to point out, Delta Dawn, or Monster Ripper, looks an awful lot better in this match with Megumi Kudo than she did against Bull Nakano.
Yeah, that's true.
What did you think of it?
This is my favorite thing on this card, unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
I felt like Monster Ripper... Is it okay if I call her that, or should I call her
Delta? Let's go with Monster Ripper.
It's just a better name. Come on, yeah. It's cooler.
Delta Dawn. It's kind of got a military thing going on there, but I don't really know why. It wasn't like she was wearing like camouflage or anything.
No, it didn't make sense to me. No. But no, Monster Ripper is really good at making a lot of things look very painful. Like, what she's doing to her opponent looks painful, even though she's protecting her opponent really well. And for somebody of her size, I felt like that was very impressive, because a lot of what she did, if she really like lands some of those chops, you know, or those kicks, it would probably really hurt a lot. I love her screaming at the ref through this entire match. That was really on point. And the audience seemed to react to it really well. I love Megumi Kudo. Like, she's so cool. You know, I think there's a reason that people talk about her being like, you know, the hardcore queen. Like, she's such a good baby face.
Yeah.
She's so earnest in her desire to win. Like, you can see how competitive she is, how it's really, really important to her to put on the best match possible and do a good job, and also to beat her opponent. But you can also, I feel like, relate to her maybe a little bit better than some of the women who were a big deal at this time, because her look is very approachable. Like, you know, at this point, she doesn't even really have, like, color in her hair or anything. She's not wearing any makeup or anything. Her costume looks like a fancy aerobic instructor outfit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, certainly compared to Monster Ripper, she's probably the more approachable of the two, because Monster Ripper's trying to be big and scary. But, I mean, like, also in general, I felt like she's fairly, like, the approachable girl next door kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's refreshing that, like, I feel like a lot of women in Joshi now are built like fitness models. And yeah, that's not necessarily to say that that's bad. I mean, a lot of the women in Joshi now are just incredibly athletic and, like, always have been. You know, I think of somebody like Io Shirai, who looks like a gymnast. But it does concern me sometimes when I see women in Joshi matches where they don't have any fat on their bodies at all, and they have to take those bumps.
Yep.
And it was kind of nice to see a match between two women who both didn't look like they came out of a fitness magazine. You know what I mean? Because, like, Megumi Kudo is obviously in really good shape, and so is Monster Ripper. I mean, like, her conditioning is obviously really good, because she does a ton of cardio in this match.
Yeah.
But they both, to some extent, look like regular people compared to what I'm used to seeing now. And for me personally, that was kind of refreshing.
I think as well, you look at certain people, like Aoki Hamada is a good example. When she was 20 years old, she was a bikini model, fitness. And a lot of her draw in ASEAN was the fact that she was this incredibly good-looking model-type woman. But 17 years later, she's put on 60 pounds because she can spread the impact of what she does as a pro wrestler a lot better. Hasn't lost any mobility, hasn't lost any moveset. She can still do the same things she could do when she was 21 as she can do when she's 38. However, life's a lot easier when she's 60 pounds heavier.
Which, yeah, I mean, you know, it's a complex thing. Like, it's hard when you talk about women's bodies because all of those conversations are so loaded. But I just appreciated that Megumi Kudo was able to be that kind of, like, sweetheart babyface that the crowd so clearly connected with, while also still looking like somebody you would bump into on the street as opposed to somebody off the cover of, like, you know, Muscle and Fitness.
Yeah, and as well at this particular time, Kudo had kind of, like, got over with the fans after losing to Combat Toyota in street fights over and over again, and she finally had won a couple. She was seen as, well, she's tough enough to deal in our environment now. You know, so this was the start of her mega push. She was being pushed. This was her getting over the top pushed. And it worked as well because, you know, her and Combat Toyota were joint aces of the company for the next 3 or 4 years and never got in each other's way, really. You know, they were a draw to different sets of people, but still both massively popular.
I actually have a question about that.
Yeah.
Are they friends? Were they friends?
Yes, they were, because they were in the AJW dojo together in 1986.
Oh, that's so nice. I love it when women who have, like, these intense rivalries that we think of as being, like, you know, classic are also, like, good pals in real life. That's so cool.
If you watch the Megumi Kudo anthology DVD, she spends a lot of time talking to Combat in the segments and stuff. And it's all based around them talking about their rookie days in AJW and what they did. They're actually sat at Kawasaki Baseball Stadium discussing Combat's final match. So
I definitely cool. have to watch that. That sounds great.
Even though I can't understand a word they're saying, but you can tell by their body language and their reactions like what they're talking about, and it's pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Right, then we move on to the semi-final, which was a hair versus mask bull rope death match between Tarzan Goto and Invader Number 4, who had been shipped in from Puerto Rico by Victor Quinnes. Now, at this particular point, there was a talent swap agreement between Puerto Rico Talent, which was run by Victor Quinnes, coming out of WWC. That was Carlos Colon's promotion. And that had been negotiated by Jesús Chionita with Invader. Yes, that Invader that had killed Bruiser Brody a couple of years beforehand and got away with it, basically, on a manslaughter charge and claimed self-defense. There was a lot of conversation in Japan about whether this was good or not, even more so when Jesús Chionita was, I couldn't I quote, stabbed whilst he was negotiating this in Puerto Rico. And it was filmed, and his pictures were taken of it and sent back to the Japanese press. And it lost an awful lot of momentum for FMW in the run-up to this time period, but they had recovered it by this point. Anita didn't think there was any such thing as bad publicity. There clearly is. This was a good example of it.
Are you sure this is Invader? Because the note that I have says Invader 4.
Yeah, the person in this match is Invader 4, but the person he negotiated the deal with was Invader 2. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
There was a lot of Invaders around. Yeah, this was a match from that particular point, that particular talent swap deal. And it's kind of confused because it's a bull rope death match, but it's not a four corners bull rope death match. It's like a Texas tornado match or Texas death match. So you pin your opponent, he's got a count of a 10 to get up, or you can just make him submit and you win the match anyway.
Yep.
So there's lots of odd things going on in this match. So the rule set's a bit weird and it's a bit disjointed and it didn't last very long. It seemed an awful lot of effort to fly all that way to lose in 4 minutes and 26 seconds. Chelsea, what did you think of this?
So I was trying to watch this match and eat a peanut butter sandwich at the same time, and don't do those two things together, because there's blood and headshots and punches to the chest, like actual real punches, not chops.
No.
That look like they hurt, and a lot of this feels kind of clumsy. I was just concerned for the welfare of both participants while I was watching it.
It did seem a bit like, we don't know each other that well, so we best make sure it hurts just to make sure we're doing a good job.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like the old thing that Mick Foley used to say about Vader was, some guys do stuff that looks great and doesn't hurt. Other guys do stuff that looks terrible and hurts like hell. Sorry, other stuff that looks terrible but doesn't hurt. And Vader left no room for error. He did stuff that looked great and it hurt. So yep. This is one of those kind of matches. This is two guys who don't really know what they're doing with one another and have no end game. It's not terrible. It's not like, you know, as our lowest bar standard is Scott Norton versus the Equalizer. It's nowhere near as bad as that.
I didn't know that was the lowest bar standard. That's great.
Yeah, that's the lowest bar we come up with so far. Me and Alex were like, there can't possibly be any worse wrestling matches than this because it was absolutely dreadful because they didn't know, well, clearly the Equalizer had no clue what he was doing and got his testicles pulled out of his tights at the end of the match. You couldn't possibly get any word. Yeah, in the Tokyo Dome on pay-per-view. There you go.
That's really sad.
To the hard camera.
Nice.
Yes, and Scott didn't let go of them tights. Anyway, so it's not that bad. Few things are. It's watchable, just, but it is a bit sloppy and messy, and you kind of wonder why, you know, he did fly all that way, really. But I suppose it was for a payday. Not that it had been that much, but yeah. Any other thoughts on that match?
I said this before, don't eat while you're watching it.
Okay, then. We'll move on to the main event. To something that was remarkably not that bloody, considering it involved Atsushi Inita. He defeated Grigoriy Verichev in 10 minutes and 44 seconds for the WWA Martial Arts Heavyweight Championship. Now, at this point, FMW was still Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling, but it was starting to move away from the formula that it had brought it to the dance. And this was one of the last cards where you get quite so much mixed martial arts involvement. And Verichev is one of the last martial artists to challenge or hold this championship belt. And it's not a bad match, because Verichev could work a little bit, and he could certainly sell in a traditional pro wrestling manner, which is often where these matches came undone. What did you think, Chelsea?
This is an interesting experience, because Onita is not one of those wrestlers who everybody loves because he's a master technician. Like, yeah. In terms of actual wrestling skill, he's probably one of the worst wrestlers that we regularly talk about on the show, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's just not much. He doesn't have that many tricks in his bag, but at the same time, he's a brilliant storyteller. Yeah. Like, he knows exactly how to get emotion out of his opponent, even when his opponent is somebody like Grigoriy Verichev, I think I'm saying it correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
Who is not somebody I think of as a terribly emotional guy. He knows how to work a crowd. He knows how to get the crowd invested. Both of these guys get themselves over, and they have a match that is, as you said before, relatively safe compared to a lot of the stuff you see in FMW. But the crowd, there's no like sacrificed emotion from the crowd, because the crowd is screaming pretty much the entire time.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's so over, these two.
Oh, my God. They both are. Like, yeah. It was, I mean, especially Onita. But, like, they both are over by the end of this match. It's very, very impressive. I love the imagery at the end of Onita getting a water bottle dumped on his head while laying face down on the mat. And the camera's, like, right in front of his face so you can see it. It's much more emotional than I expected.
Yeah. Yeah, this was kind of the point when they realized Onita couldn't dance alone. He needed someone to go with to make really big money. He can go with a guy like Verichev and make it interesting, but you needed your Terry Funks and you needed your Tenrus really to get things really moving along. Yeah, this was really good and cool stuff. You know, this was very interesting stuff as far as like how to make a non-worker a sellable entity in a wrestling match. I think, as well. Because Verichev's an impressive physical specimen. Big, big dude. He can move. And he made, like, you know, he just did backdrop diver-like throws for about 5 minutes. He just hurled Onita around. That's all he needed to do to make himself look like an attraction. And it worked.
It's very cool. Like, they clearly have a connection. Those two dudes get each other.
Yeah, definitely. Now, after this card, that main event was, you know, pretty good for FMW. We've been going for 2 years, 5,000 people into that size of arena. That was pretty impressive for what they were trying to do, you know. But things change, things move on. They started making decent money, as we talked about before. They got a signing on deal for going into LaserDisc, that's the one, a format that died 15 years ago. Going into LaserDisc production. Actually, to be fair, LaserDisc was really important in Japan. So they're starting to get more money around. They're starting to spend money on production, but they're not starting to spend money on wrestling talent. Remarkably, who's ever heard of a promoter not paying their workers that well? Have you, Chelsea?
Yikes.
Yes.
That's unfortunate.
And also, there was some quibbles about Onita being the top guy in the company and being what he says goes. And four or five of the people who were involved in this particular problem were Victor Quinez, who we talked about, who was bringing in a lot of the talent from Florida and a lot of the talent from Puerto Rico. Miki Ibriagi and Keizushi Osaka, who were both the executives of the company and had helped found FMW, and Mr. Pogo, who was kind of getting a little bit the short end of the stick when it came to money and when it came to creative direction. So those guys all left to form Wing Wrestling International New Generations, a new group that concentrated on hardcore wrestling. And we'll probably look at some Wing because there was some very interesting stuff that happened in Wing and what happened after Wing, which is IWA. But, you know, that's a bit in the future. We're trying to concentrate on FMW in 1991, but it had an obvious influence on what the company had to do because, you know, they had to then make some new stars. They had to change their ideas up altogether. And their next big show is Kawasaki Baseball Stadium, the second anniversary show on the 23rd of September in 1991. Now, 33,000 people turned up to that show, so you can imagine it was quite good. Or, you know, it drew money. Let's not say it was quite good. Chelsea, what did you think of this card? And with that context, what do you think the differences are between this and what you'd watched previously?
So this has more of a big higher-end production value. Like, they do the film at the beginning where they show you, like, assembling the ring in the middle of the stadium and the close-up of Onita as he walks through and inspects everything to make sure it's okay. Like, kind of sets the tone as, like, hey, this is a really big event. We spent a lot of money on it. The card itself is interesting. I think that the YouTube version that I watched is sort of like a highlights reel. Like, I did get to see some of the full matches, but I think there's a couple in there that are cut short. It's exciting, and it feels a little more deliberate than the house show, or not house show, but the card that came before this. It's also, how do I put this? There's fewer matches where the audience seems confused about what's going on. Pretty much everything that happens, it seems like the audience knows who all the participants are and they're excited about it already.
Yeah. It was just a lot more intended.
Yes. which is good. And that's not to say that I love every match on this card, but the stuff that works really works.
Okay. Well, we'll start with the first match, which was Eiji Izaki versus Masahiro Honda. Now, Mr. Izaki would be very, very influential in FMW in the years to come because he would become Hayabusa, arguably the greatest aerial wrestler that FMW ever produced, and certainly an incredible star attraction in his own right after he came back from his learning excursions. But at this point, he was still an FMW guy, and he was still just a rookie. But he wins the match in 7 minutes and 22 seconds. What did you think of this, Chelsea?
This is much, much faster than any of the men's matches on the previous card. So that stood out to me right away. The technical level in this is very good, but it's just really short. So it's just not a big story that they're telling. It's just like a cool little match where they both get to show off and do a bunch of their cool spots.
Yeah, and this is quite interesting because I just clicked in my mind. I was like, Masahiro Honda, I know that name, and it was Mr. Ganesuke. These guys would feud literally for the rest of their careers.
Well, they have serious wrestling chemistry, so that makes sense.
They were at high school together.
Really?
Yeah. And
that's amazing.
The anniversary show in 1999 was the main event in a street fight refereed by Shawn Michaels.
Wow.
And it was essentially that 7-year story of them two, you know, being childhood rivals, being friends at school, being childhood rivals at amateur wrestling, being childhood rivals in the dojo. Izaki was an Anita guy. Honda was a Goto guy. They were, you know, they came from different cliques within the dressing room, but they were always had this rivalry. And it was showed really sensible long-term storytelling. The company was able to rely on this story for 7 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Okay. Move on to the second match, which was an 8-woman battle royal, which was pretty fun and entertaining and was won by Miyu Saito. I love the fact that everyone was scared of Shark Tikishura and Mad Dog Matamori, so they all ganged up on them eventually. So it came down to Shark Tikishura and Miyu Saito, who's a tiny, tiny lady, who then managed to get a submission victory onto Shark Tikishura. So this was brilliant. I just loved this. What did you think, Chelsea?
This is insane. This is great. It's a lot of fun. It's some of the highest level of like technical execution on this particular card because one of the things that I think is interesting about FMW is, like we were talking about Onita in particular before, not everybody who wrestles for FMW is a great wrestler. Like, no. They all have something that makes them cool and unique, but there are a lot of people in this card and the card before it where I watch them and I go, not sure that what they do would necessarily work on another platform. All the women in this match not only know how to wrestle, but they also know how to get themselves, like, noticed. They know how to stand out on camera. And that was really interesting to me because it's so short, but everybody does something really interesting. Everybody finds a way to make themselves stand out for the time that they have allotted. And it kind of felt like a WrestleMania Divas match, except everybody was awesome.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Everything that happened was worthwhile.
Yeah.
You're telling a new story. Like, Matamori needs to go crazy on the rookies and eliminate a couple of them, but gets eliminated herself. Miyu Sato clearly isn't the biggest dog in the fight, but she's the smartest.
And she sneaks through. Like, you feel... She seems very jubilant when she wins, and like you feel that the crowd feels for her because they're sort of blown away by the fact that she's survived all of this chaos.
Yeah, and she still gets a dominant moment by making the number two heel submit to her ankle lock. So, you know, she sneaked it, but it was a good sneaked it. You know, it was a bit closer to a full clean victory. So, yeah
it's believable.
Yeah. So move on then to the tag match, which was Horace Boulder and The Shooter versus Jimmy Backlund and Kim Han Han. The Shooter was a guy who's still wrestling, actually. He's called Katsuyori Naoyama. He's 48 years old now. And, you know, Horace doing his Horace-ing thing. It was all right, this, for 12 minutes and 48 seconds. It was a proper tag match. Kim Han Han was, I would guess he's a kung fu fighter, judging by his style and the vocal stylings he attached to what he was doing. It was interesting, but it was a wrestling match. It wasn't a different style fight. So this was a bit more traditional and a bit more for Horace to hang his head around. And also, Horace Boulder using the Axe Bomber finisher, his uncle, Hulk Hogan, used that as his finisher in Japan. So, you know, it was interesting to see him use that because he did shout out, Axe Bomber, before he delivered it, which was cool. Chelsea, what did you think of this match?
So the major thing that stood out to me is that I think Jimmy Backlund stands out more as a tag team wrestler than he does as a singles guy. Mm. Because everything he did in the card before this, where he was wrestling one-on-one, it was all really well executed, but there was nothing that he did that made me think, oh, wow, that guy has serious star power. You know, like, look at the way he did that particular move. It stands out so much. Mm-hmm. And in this match, he's really good at coming in off a hot tag and kind of stealing the spotlight and making the crowd, like, scream, you know? And he doesn't marshal that energy quite as well when he's working one-on-one with somebody. I just think, like, something about the way he wrestles works better with the layout of a tag team match.
Yeah, definitely. It's a style thing, isn't it? It fits what he's doing.
I think so. Maybe it's just more exciting to him, you know? Sometimes, like, a lot of times in art, the thing that the artist enjoys the most is actually the thing that other people connect to the most easily. So maybe that was just his favorite thing. I don't know.
Fair enough. And then we move on to, well, the ridiculous. Akihito Ichihiri, Amigo Ultra, and Ultraman Cheeto defeated El Pandita, Pandita Chiquita, and Yukihito Uno. I'll get it right in the end. 11 minutes and 19 seconds. And, oh, it's pretty ridiculous Lucha Libre match, to be honest with you. We talked about this on the first anniversary show because Amigo Ultra and Ultraman Cheeto were on that show as well. And it was the same kind of midget wrestling madness you come to expect and love with some incredibly big bumps. Pandita Chiquita, I think we talked about before, he's ex-Petitro in AAA, and his current gimmick is El Torito of WWE and CMLL fame.
Yep.
So, you know, he's still wrestling some 27 years later, and still one of the best monster heels in wrestling as well, and incredibly fast. But yes, what did you think of this?
So, you know, it's your typical match where a lucha robot fights a dude dressed like a bear,
yeah,
and a strongman and a super stiff athletic wrestler dude who kind of seems like he doesn't really know what's going on. This match is so weird. Like, it's like the sideshow attractions at a circus all got together and had a wrestling match.
Yeah. Yeah. It's basically it. Including the animals.
Yep.
It's one of those FMW things. I just think Anita just like, you can just see Anita standing in the background, funny.
It's the cool down. Like, yeah. It's the, everybody laughs, everybody has a good time, everybody gets to take a deep breath before the stuff that happens next.
And while the stuff that happened next was pretty serious because it was the WWA Women's Championship held by Combat Toyota defending against Reggie Bennett in an Indian strap match. And this was fairly violent for what it was. 11 minutes and 36 seconds. To be fair, I think if it was a straight up wrestling match, it probably would have been a bit better. But certainly they used the strap, they got some things in there, and it was the strap that created the finish because essentially Toyota strangled Bennett with it. Because there was no rules, so he just choked with the strap.
Yep.
What did you think of this, Chelsea?
I love Combat Toyota because she's very scary, and terrifying. She's very scary in a way where I'm not necessarily afraid in real life, like when I really think about it, that she's gonna hurt her opponents. But she's so good at just being that super intimidating character where, I mean, you watch her walk to the ring and you think she's gonna beat the crap out of somebody. And I mean, that's what she does in this match. And Reggie Bennett, I didn't know anything about her, but she's clearly good. I mean, she's good enough to hang with Combat Toyota, so she knows what she's doing. But, she just didn't stand a chance. Like, come on, dude. I saw her come out there. I was like, oh, honey. This is not going to go well for you. It's fun, and I like that FMW gave really good women's wrestlers, like Combat Toyota in particular, the opportunity to do some cool creative things that they would not have really been allowed to do anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, Reggie Bennett was an AJW regular at this point. She was coming in and doing tours for them. And she did pretty well. If I remember correctly, she did pretty well in the All Japan Women Grand Prix in 1991. I think she got to the semi-final.
Hmm.
So, yeah, she was pretty good in this particular
time. Was she
in the
card we watched?
No, that was the 1990 Grand Prix. It was the following year. She was there for the following year. And she kind of... her gimmick of... I don't quite get her gimmick. Like, she's a construction worker. Why? What in what possible way does that help her as a pro wrestler? And there was a couple of them. There's a couple of them in AJW as well. And like in the later in the 90s, there was one who was a road worker. She came to the ring with a helmet on and a pickaxe. And you're just like, why?
That feels to me like leftover influence from the 80s.
Yeah. And I don't quite get it. But there she was. You know. Yep. This was also the time period of the LCO Space Cadets, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, everything was happening. It was all going on. Now, rather bizarrely, there was another women's match straight afterwards. And the sensible thing to do, surely, would have been put the championship match on second. But they didn't. What they put on instead was this Svetlana Gordarenko. And she defeated Megumi Kudo in 9 minutes 50 seconds. Svetlana was a terrifying-looking woman. There is no other way to describe it. She was massive. Huge! Yes. Couldn't wrestle a lick, but she could throw people and kick people quite hard. And that's what she did to Megumi Kudo for 9 minutes and 50 seconds. What did you think of this, Chelsea?
She pulls Megumi Kudo up from the ground by her hair. And, yeah, like, literally pulls her up by her hair. Not the way most wrestlers do it now, where they kind of, like, you know, tug just a little until the other person comes up. This hurts. It looks like it hurts. It's not great storytelling, but Megumi Kudo is really good at selling and really good at being in pain in a way that makes the crowd really angry when she loses. Also, I like that somewhere between the last card we watched and this card, she added a random blonde streak to her hair. I felt like that was an expression of her growing self-esteem as a baby face.
Megumi Kudo and her perfect hair.
Yeah. She has spectacular hair. Really, really good hair.
Yeah. Yeah, we can't say enough about Megumi Kudo's hair. There's only two people I've seen roughly up, and that was Akira Okuto, and I think Combat managed to ruffle it in that. No, it'd be Shout Tikisho when she set fire to it. Yeah, that'd be it.
She set fire to her hair?
Yeah. You've not seen that angle?
I'm really glad that I haven't. Oh. That sounds awful.
When we get to 1996, you're not going to be happy. Anyway... You're going to have to go watch that now, aren't you? Yeah, don't watch that. Don't watch that anthology DVD.
Okay.
Okay.
Good tip.
Yes. But yeah, it was interesting, certainly, to see how, like, they transferred the FMW different style match kind of thing that they were doing to this. And Kudo is just so good as a wrestler. She could literally have a match with a broomstick and make it work. And I think this was one of those occasions, really.
Yep.
Okay, so we move on then to the Street Fight stretcher match. Big Titan and the Gladiator facing up against the now-face Riki Fuji, who turned face in the previous year, and Sambo Osako. Now, these four guys, wrestled each other at every anniversary show for what seemed like 3 years. and their feud was continually going on and off over the FMW Brass Knuckles Tag Team Championship. 11 minutes and 12 seconds of an ass-whooping, and that was Fuji and Osako getting the ass-whooping. But they did get some shots in, but this was stiff as houses. And it was quite entertaining. There was some borderline stuff I definitely wouldn't want to see in a wrestling match now. What do you think of that with this, Chelsea?
So first of all, it's really important to mention there are some excellent mullets.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's a full gloss. In fact, Osako is the only one without a mullet, and he just shaved his off. Because he's got short back and sides, hasn't he, at this point? Whereas before, he'd had that flowing mullet. I don't quite understand why he'd not got with the program, really, for this match.
I don't know. No. I don't know why he is mulletless, and it is sad. But everybody else has fully embraced the mullet. so that's very important to note. The spot in this match that I like the best is when Sambo Osako just goes for that giant crossbody spot and the crowd goes nuts. And you're like, how did he do that? Because he's like, it doesn't really look like he should have enough height to do that jump when he does it.
Yeah.
Other than that, you know, I mean, like, this is good. This is stiff, but it felt like they did this as a, like, not a cool down, but it felt like they did this so that the audience could decompress a little bit from all their very strong feelings about Megumi Kudo losing before they get to the main and semi-main matches.
Yeah, I think that's right. It could have gone with being about 5 minutes longer and pacing things a bit better. I think. But it was entertaining for what it was, and you kind of get the idea of how good Mike Awesome's going to be in the next 5 or 6 years. How good Riki Fuji potentially could be. You know, Rick Bogner not so much, but he was never that much great. But he kind of, like, you got the idea he could be a really dominant big guy. You know, he's not as good as Mike Awesome is, but he's doing cool and interesting things. So there's a lot of potential there for the company. And noticeably, because they have that Florida connection, that's where they came from, they haven't left the company with Victor Quinez, which bodes well for FMW. Because FMW could have been in quite a lot of trouble if they'd lost any more talent at that particular point, and they didn't. So we'll move on then to the next match, which was a mixed-style match. Grigory Virichev, our old friend in the blue gi, he fights Katsuji Ueda, he of the glorious perm and boxing gloves, the Muay Thai specialist, who's kind of been an FMW fixture at this point, in a mixed style match. 16 minutes and 44 seconds, to be honest, a bit long. But it was entertaining for what it was, especially for two non-wrestlers who essentially were having a fixed wrestling match. But they were kind of doing things all wrong, and it jogged along all okay. What did you think of this, Chelsea?
This felt like you were saying about how, like, there's that kind of... There's two guys who are not wrestlers having a wrestling match, so it feels a little off. But at the same time, the crowd was so invested in it that I was kind of like, well, clearly the crowd's excited about it. What do they know that I don't? And watching it, I could kind of see, I'm like, well, this really shouldn't work, but it kind of does. Like, I don't know that I can put my finger on exactly why it does. Maybe it's just because those guys had worked together and knew each other really well and were able to make it work. It's not my personal cup of tea, is like, you know, that's not my favorite match on this card, but it is cool and it does work. It does go on a little bit long, though.
Yeah, it's very watchable. It's entertaining, but it's not necessarily, you know, it's not what you watch wrestling for, per se. But equally, having said that, there's a story there, kind of. And, you know, it's about comebacks and who's going to survive. It's just a war of attrition. And sometimes that's well worth watching. So
yeah.
And then we get on to the main event of the anniversary show, too, and why 33,000 people had taken the bullet train to Kawasaki Baseball Stadium. No rope exploding barbed wire cage death match between Atsushi Inita and Tarzan Goto. Now, Tarzan Goto, on the last card we watched, was a face. But with the departure of Mr. Pogo, Inita needed an opponent. So Goto was actually wrestling Sambo Osako in a barbed wire street fight. They were both faces, and Osako took a hell of a beating from Goto, who saw a cut and went after it. Inita had a right go at Goto, and Goto turned heel for the purposes of this match. And 33,000 is a lot of people, so it was well worth that heel turn. But you'd already seen this match a year before, on the last time when we talked about this, in a no-rope barbed wire exploding barbed wire death match then. But this one was a little bit different. Inside the cage, the production values for this were actually really, really cool, and the way they shot the cage was really, really impressive, I thought, as well. They did it in black and white. They showed the whole setup. This kind of amplified the danger in the production when you're watching the show, and there was certainly a big element of risk involved in this match. And because they'd done it once, they knew how to get the best out of it, because the environment had changed a little bit. Potentially, it was still the same thing. Save your bumps for when you need them. What do you think of this, Chelsea?
So this is really cool. This is really intense. This is similar to what we were talking about, like, about the main event on the last card, where it is surprisingly emotional to me. I don't think of Atsushi Onita and FMW and hardcore wrestling fans as talking a lot about the emotional investment that they have. You know, I mean, like, they talk about, like, certain guys triumph over other guys, but they talk a lot about, like, how grisly things are and, you know, how dangerous everything is. And that stuff stands out, but none of that stuff matters unless you really care about the welfare of the people involved while you're watching it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's the whole thing, isn't it? You know, it's like, I don't think you needed the barbed wires and explosions and the gore necessarily to make this match work, because people care about Tarzan Goto and they care about Atsushi Inita.
They really do. Like, they start screaming from before both of them are even, like, in the ring, because they know what's coming.
Yeah, you know, these two impressive workers, well, maybe not Sunita so much. Goto's okay. Neither of them are going to tear the house down in a classic wrestling match, but they are so good at telling a story, and they're so good at using their environment. You know, I watch a lot of deathmatch wrestling, especially from Japan Freedoms and stuff, and there's a couple of wrestlers there. I think you could be so much bigger. You don't need all this junk. You do it because you like it, and that's fine. But it kind of, like, you know, it's defying the point, because people are supposed to care about you before you do all these things, you know.
Yeah.
And the big reason why this worked is because you cared about Inita and because you cared about Goto, and they were fighting over a principle. You don't get that much anymore in pro wrestling, do you?
Yeah. Not really.
You know,
and I mean, like, you can watch those two guys lock up and shuffle back and forth in this match, where, you know, there's no, like, I don't think there's any high spots in this match because nobody can get up on the buckle, right?
No,
so it's so. it's all just ring work from two guys who aren't really known for their ring work, but it still works because they're so good at building that tension there that, I mean, I was watching it and I ended up watching the whole thing in one sitting, which is not normally what I expect to do when I'm watching a death match.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. And it was important, you know, it was a really good show. It was a really good show ender. It was dramatic. Everything was working really well for the company. 33,321 fans. That's a lot of money. They're doing good business at this particular point. Where do you see the company after watching these two cards in this year, taking everything out of context and looking bad at it nearly 30 years later? Where do you see the company in regards to the other things we've been watching?
That's interesting. So, you know, when we did the first FMW recording that we did, we were talking about how without talking about Atsushi Onita, you're sort of like, you have a missing piece of the puzzle of what was going on in this time period. Because there's so much that they did that was so groundbreaking.
Yeah.
You know, like I could see how without this stuff, you wouldn't have ECW. And without this stuff, you wouldn't have CZW. And also, you know, I mean, of course, my favorite part of FMW and what I've watched of it is the women's wrestling. It really felt like there was stuff that the women's wrestlers or the women wrestlers got to do in FMW that they weren't even really allowed to do in promotions that we think of as being like, you know, the beacon of women's wrestling, like AJW.
Yeah.
You know, it sort of feels to me like FMW fits into the landscape in 1991 as being like the scrappy underdog who turns out to be surprisingly popular. No one's expecting them to be one of the cool kids, and yet somehow they are.
Yeah, I think so as well. I mean, they were an independent company, technically speaking, but how independent can you be, really, when the other companies are independent companies as well? It's just that they've been established, they've come from this lineage of how a wrestling company works, and FMW didn't. That doesn't make them any worse or any better, it just means they're going to be different. And they were. And it was based upon basic principles of wrestling that Giant Baba had established in the previous 20 years. That's where Onita learned, so that's what it was going to look like. You know, there's a very kind of like line between what Baba was doing in the 1970s and what Onita was doing in the 1990s. They're very similar things. And, you know, and you put in that influence of the Funk Brothers, because that's where Onita did his time, and his time in Memphis under Jerry Lawler and Jerry Jarrett. And you're going to get these ideas that are new to the Japanese market, probably quite well known to the southern United States market, but it's a different thing. And you're starting to get this cross-pollination of ideas, and he's doing things differently. That's what I like about it, I think. He's not afraid to take risks and do things differently. Sometimes those risks don't pay off, like his trip to Puerto Rico, which he probably should have stayed home. However, I do think it's important that people do try different things from time to time, because we do get a lot of wrestling which is safe these days, and there's nothing wrong with that. I want people to be as safe as they possibly can be, but you know, the things that stick and the things that are memorable are the different ideas, the things that you do, and you do things differently. And you know, as I talk to pro wrestlers and as I talk to fans and stuff, they're the things that stick out that they've done differently are often the ideas that stick, and this is a wrestling promotion that's entirely different.
Yeah, there's nothing else out there that's exactly like FMW.
It's good and terrible and everything in between. Well, that gives us to the end of our episode of The Beginner's Guide to Professional Wrestling, episode 20. 20 of these. 20 hours you can listen to of this.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I can't believe we started this like, 10 months ago. We've got 20 episodes together of it now, an entire series. So we'll be moving on to 1992 in the next five episodes. I hope you look forward to that. Next week, we're going to the Best of Super Juniors final, and we're going to be covering the entire Best of Super Juniors tournament, Jushin Thunder Liger's last ever Best of Super Juniors tournament. It's going to be epic, so you should join us next week. And we'll get back to the beginner's guide in a couple of weeks' time. We've got some New Japan things to talk about at the moment, though. So I'd like to say thank you to my guest today, Miss Chelsea Spolin of shouldersup.net. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And you can follow her at Chelsea Comics and at shoulders_up. You can follow me at Sheriff Lone Star, and you can follow WrestleTalk TV at WrestleTalk_TV on Twitter. Thank you very much for listening today. Please do listen to The Squash with Gavin Duenas and Ben Spindler. And you can also check up Ollie Davis and all his friends on the YouTube channel. Please do listen to them and watch them too. Take care, and we'll see you next week. Bye!